Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Heritage Matters, a programme brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust and kindly sponsored by Ryman Healthcare. I'm Dougal Stevenson. In this programme, we talk to Dunedin historian Dr. Jane McCabe about her latest research on Tairi farming families. We learn how the New Zealand social welfare system had its beginnings in Otago. And we reminisce about some of Dunedin's early department stores, especially those with special Christmas attractions. But first, some items of heritage news. An Aramoana man, Bill Brown, has put forward a proposal to save the Sims Building in Port Chalmers. The building is the former Stevenson and Cook Foundry and is understood to be the only pre-1900 building connected to our maritime history still standing. Following public submissions, the future of the building will be considered by the City Council next year. Bill Brown earlier restored the Art Deco Angus Motor Building in Princess Street. Following Dunedin's example, Oamaru has appointed a heritage advisor. Heather Bokup has taken up the role after 15 years with Heritage New Zealand. In her new role, she'll help owners protect historic buildings and advise on their refurbishment and reuse. And a similar role has been established in Central Otago as part of the new Central Otago Heritage Trust, which aims to provide an overview, communication and coordination of heritage matters in the district. Alice Spears has been appointed coordinator. The first two of 15 information panels celebrating the history of the University of Otago were unveiled recently outside the historic professorial houses. The panels include early photographs from just after they were built in 1878. Also in the series of panels at historic university sites will be the Clock Tower Building, the Medical School, the Staff Club and Marama Hall. The university is celebrating its 150th anniversary next year. Heritage apple orchards are to be planted across the southern South Island. A Riverton-based group has spent the past decade collecting heritage apple grafting stock from around the region and planted its first orchard in Kaitangata in September with another plan for Owaka. During the project, more than 700 varieties had been rediscovered next to farmhouses and by roadsides. Their value is seen in their flavour and disease resistance and also their history, many being brought here in the mid-19th century. And as usual, we thank the Otago Daily Times for those stories. Dunedin historian Dr. Jane McCabe was recently named co-winner of the National Ian Wards Prize for her outstanding contribution to New Zealand historical scholarship. Here's Judy Southworth.
In a program last year, we interviewed Dr. Jane McCabe of the History Department of Otago University about her doctoral thesis and subsequent book, Race, Tea and Colonial Resettlement. It's about the immigration to Otago of groups of young people from India early in the 19th century. Her grandmother was one of these young people, who were all children of British tea planters and local women. Today, Dr. McCabe is with us again to tell us about her latest project, this time based on Tairi farming families. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
Tell us about your current research.
The idea came from my awareness that inheritance was quite a difficult thing for farming families over the generations. So I kept hearing these stories about how it was increasingly difficult for families to keep the farm in the family, and also this kind of public debate about the cost of farms being in corporate ownership rather than family ownership. So it seemed like a topic that was not only had a rich history, but one that was quite pertinent to current debates. And I was also aware that historically it had often been quite a difficult model for families to carry out, especially as we get through the 20th century and there's more of an aspiration to have equity between siblings. So if the idea of passing the farm to the eldest son, I mean, that was the kind of the ideal model. But when this new idea of having equity among siblings came along, then suddenly that model became quite difficult. So for me, as someone who's interested in family silences, which was something that was a big part of my previous study as well, this seemed like a topic that deserved to be studied. And from my initial inquiries, it was very clear that there had never been a major historical study of intergenerational land transfer in New Zealand, which when you consider how central the idea of farming families is to our national narrative, is quite surprising.
Which Tairi immigrant groups are you focusing on?
So, yeah, I designed the study to work with the way that I do research, which, as I said, is to do with families, but also culture. So this is a cross-cultural study of inheritance practice. And Tairi is a good place to think about cross-cultural studies because we not only have Scottish immigrants who established early farming here, but also Chinese market gardeners, for example, who we might not traditionally think of as farming families. But when you think about Chinese market gardeners and their relationship to the land, they face all of the same kind of issues as a Scottish family might, as far as wanting to keep that land in the family. And another immigrant group that I came across once I started the study was the Polish families at Allenton, so they're of interest too. And of course, the Ngāi Tahu families, who many of whom remained and intermarried with those European settlers as well.
Along with the Tairi families, you're also carrying out a parallel study in Hokianga. Why?
That's right. So when I designed the study, I think Tairi was the obvious place for me to start. So I grew up in Mosgiel. I didn't grow up in a farming family on the Tairi as such, but my father was a diesel mechanic. So he serviced farm machinery on the Tairi for about 40 years. So I have good connections to Tairi families through him. But also that was a way for me when I was growing up to understand some of the issues that farming families face. So Tairi was the obvious starting point. That's somewhere where I had good connections and I knew something about the history. But in doing this study, my real primary focus was on that relationship between people and land. So I wanted to avoid simply writing another history of the Tairi. So I thought the best way to avoid doing that is to have somewhere else for contrast and comparison. So I thought I'd go somewhere completely different. So I partly chose Hokianga because I don't have any connections there. I didn't have any pre-existing knowledge.
Any surprises so far in the Hokianga interviews?
It is very different. So I guess there are two things that were really striking. So the first one was the level of state intervention in farming there. So right all the way through the development of the rural sector there, there has been state intervention, partly because of that, the Māori title, so land still being in Māori title, and in the early period, the Crown trying to get hold of that land, basically, in quite a long, complicated process. And the other thing that goes alongside that is just how different the land titles have worked there.
Do you need people to come forward with information that could help?
I do. I'd love to hear from any families who have connections to the Tairi or to Hokianga. You never know. So I'm really just getting into my intensive Tairi research phase at the moment. So for the next 6 months, I'll be going out and talking to families and talking to community groups as well. For the study, I've said that in each area I'll have 5 case study families. But as I did with my previous research, I like to talk to as many people as I can. So you don't need to be officially involved in the study for me to get a lot of benefit from talking to you about your family experiences.
Judy Southworth talking to Dunedin historian Dr. Jane McCabe. In our last program, we visited the Kurau Heritage Centre, and you heard about the 3 wise men from there, men who had a key role in the creation of our public health and welfare systems. And in this story, Bill Southworth expands our coverage of this important part of New Zealand's social history.
During the Great Depression of the 1930s, 3 men who strongly believed that society could be changed for the better found themselves working together in the Waitaki River township of Kurau. There was Presbyterian minister Arnold Nordmeyer, the local doctor Gervin McMillan, and the headmaster of Kurau School, Andrew Davidson. Nordmeyer and Davidson were Dunedin-born, and McMillan was a graduate of the Otago Medical School. At that time, the nearby hydro village for the Waitaki Dam was bursting at the seams. There were 2,000 workers and their families. There's also a large contingent of 350 unemployed men who lived in what became known as the Willows, a village of tents and shacks made out of the willow branches and flattened fuel cans. They lived in the hope that they might eventually get a job helping to build the dam. There was widespread malnutrition. Their children went about in cast-off clothing. And during the bitter winters, whole families slept in one bed just to stay warm. Although there were some wealthy sheep station owners in the area, there were also many small farmers teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. It was not uncommon for men to give up and walk off the land. Nordmeyer, Davidson and Macmillan were devout Christians, and they had another thing in common. They were also Christian socialists, and they did not like the misery they saw around them in depression-hit New Zealand. Andrew Davidson later wrote,
"The ideology of the Christian socialist is set deeper and is more penetrating than that of the conventional church attender. We were fired with a fervent desire to create a new society."
According to Dr. Bill Such in his book Poverty and Progress, Arnold Nordmeyer delivered
powerful, soul-searching pleas from the pulpit, which affected, on the one hand, poignant soul-searching and sympathy, and on the other, among the social elite, frigid, silent hostility. The latter reaction can be easily understood. As in one sermon, he stated it would be a blessing from God if some well-to-do people in the Waitaki Valley were to lose three-quarters of their wealth.
Dr. Macmillan and the schoolteacher Andrew Davidson were also part of Nordmeyer's congregation. The three men were not only connected by their strong Presbyterian faith, but also by their belief in the need to change society. They formed a branch of the Labour Party and used to sit around the kitchen table trying to work out solutions to the suffering they saw around them. Under the current medical system, people had to pay to visit doctors, and also much of the cost of going to a hospital, something the poor often couldn't afford and so often went without. Dr. Macmillan suggested a way medical services might be made accessible for all. He said they should use the way the Waitaki Medical Association was run and turn that into a national system. So, what was the Waitaki Medical Association? Well, Macmillan's predecessor, Dr. Watt, in the Public Works Department, had set up the association. Under it, workers paid 4 shillings and threepence a month, and this gave them free medical and hospital care. 60% of their fees went to the local doctor, and 30% went to the Oamaru Hospital Board. Could a similar system be introduced to cover the whole of New Zealand? The three wise men thought so. But first, they also expanded it into a comprehensive welfare system. As Nordmeyer described it later,
"It would merge the health and superannuation ideas into one, resulting in a scheme which would provide for all eventualities such as sickness, invalidity, accidents, unemployment, widowhood and old age, all life's hazards, which all too frequently brought hardship."
The Labour Party had been pushing for a comprehensive social security plan since the 1920s. When Dr. Macmillan presented their idea at the Labour Party's annual conference in 1934, it was adopted in principle. The ideas from Kurau were thus incorporated in the first Labour government's 1938 Social Welfare Act. The medical and welfare entitlements were for all and were funded by a social security tax taken from salaries and wages. Little did they know that this would cause ripples around the world. It helped inspire the United Kingdom's future National Health Service, and many years later, even one of President Obama's affordable health care team came to Kurau to study how the scheme worked. Macmillan and Nordmeyer were elected to Parliament and became Ministers of Health in Labour governments. It fell to Nordmeyer to see the health proposals through to legislation, but it proved to be a hard slog because of opposition from many in the medical profession. But Nordmeyer was up to the job. Robert Muldoon, a future National Prime Minister, later described him as
a remarkable politician and parliamentarian, as straight as they come. Probably the most brilliant mind of any politician in my time.
However, the New Zealand division of the British Medical Association vigorously opposed the involvement of the state in medicine, and particularly the idea of having to recover set GP's fees from the government. They eventually relented, but only so long as they could charge patients a further fee if they chose to, on top of the government's payment per patient. So there you have it. Three men whose names have been largely forgotten, but who were the key architects of our social security system. One that sees every child born with free maternity care and, in their old age, a decent pension so they can live out their years in some dignity. In Curragh, outside what was Dr. McMillan's house, the Otago branch of the Historic Places Trust has erected a plaque. It says, "From 1925 to 1934, this was the home and surgery of Dr. D.J. McMillan, who, with the Reverend A.H. Nordmeyer, A.M. Davidson, and other Labour Party stalwarts, adopted the medical benefits scheme devised for the Waitaki Hydro workers into the basis of a social security scheme for all New Zealanders."
That report from Bill Southworth. As Christmas draws near, those of us who don't shop online will no doubt head for the department stores downtown to do our Christmas shopping. Anne Barraclough reminisces about some of our long-gone department stores and the Christmas attractions they offered.
"Stand still while I tie the bow in your hair," my exasperated mother would say. "I do not want to be seen in town with two little gutter snipes." Primped and preened, my little sister and I were off into Cape Town for a rare trip to Garlick's or Cartwright's, the two big department stores. Later at boarding school in Auckland, it would be a tram trip into the dentist, with unauthorised excursions into Smith & Coe's or Milne & Choice's. By my student days in Dunedin, Brown and Ewing was gone, but the DSA, the DIC, Arthur Barnett's and Penrose's were still here. Oh, the glamour, the elegance, the excitements in the days when an annual sale really was an annual sale, when we made our own and our children's clothes, and the trip to town, with the pram or pushchair hooked onto the front of the bus, was a special event indeed, an outing to dress up for. As a child, I remember most of all the enchantment of a trip to see Santa's house in a big department store in Cape Town. Standing tiptoe, you look into the front window of a tiny snow-capped doll's house. Inside, a little Santa and his elves are busy making toys. Santa greets you with a merry ho-ho-ho and pops a tiny present into a chute. By magic, it arrives, now miraculously the size of a large Cornish packet, containing various gifts suitable for whether you are a girl or a boy. I realise now that Santa's window was probably optical glass and that Santa was, in fact, normal-sized. Pixie Town in the DIC was greatly enjoyed by my children each Christmas and now has a new home in Toitū. Many listeners will remember the old department stores, the wonderful tea rooms and restaurants, the elegant restrooms, the lift attendant telling you what was on each floor, chairs for the elderly or pregnant, and being personally shown items from little drawers behind the counters, leather gloves, dainty packs of handkerchiefs. The department stores developed overseas in city centres in the mid-19th century. In Dunedin, in 1849, a Mrs. Bain, a widow, opened a drapery store near the corner of Princes and Mann Streets. After changing hands several times, it became known as Brown Ewing. In 1874, it expanded further along Mance and Prince's Streets, having the largest Main Street frontage of any retail company in the colony, the 1903 New Zealand Cyclopedia tells us. There were by then over 200 employees and orders were dispatched to all parts of the colony. In 1884, the Hallenstein family opened a wholesale warehouse in Dunedin, the Drapery Importing Company, supplied by a clothing factory they had established in 1873. Christchurch and Wellington branches were added in 1885 and 1886. The Christchurch store had a department which manufactured bicycles. The Dunedin branch fronted High and Rattray Streets, with floor space covering an acre and a half. In 1894, Father Christmas made his first appearance in a department store in New Zealand, in Dunedin's DIC. The Farmers Trading Company started as a mail-order firm for farmers, becoming a department store in 1920 and spread throughout New Zealand. Most of the goods in the department stores were imported from Britain, but by 1923 New Zealand buyers were also in New York and Yokohama, buying end-of-season goods at sale prices, ready for our season. The stores all had large workrooms, making garments and hats to supplement their imports. Elaborate and artistic window displays enticed shoppers into the glamorous and luxurious interior. In 1903, Herbert Haynes & Company opened a large store fronting the Octagon and Princes Street. In October 1923, it was taken over by the DIC, which remained there until it closed, Hallenstein's Menswear taking a part of the ground floor. Another large shop fronting the Octagon was Butterfield's, operating from 1858 to 1993, where I was invited with other customers to watch television, newly available in New Zealand, in the early 1960s. I may even have seen a young Dougal Stevenson reading the news. In the early 1980s, I attended a demonstration of the revolutionary newly invented kitchen wonder, the microwave, at Patterson and Bars in High Street. The big stores also held fabulous fashion shows. For the staff, there were sports clubs and outings, and the DSA had its own marching team. At Christmas, the staff formed choirs and entertained shoppers with carols. And what Dunedin family did not own one of the little pink wooden rocking chairs sold for only 2 and 6 pence each Christmas at Calder Mackay's in Rattray Street? Department stores have been called the expression of 19th and 20th century consumerism. In an era of greater leisure time, they offered shopping as a new pastime. The handsome building on the corner of George and Frederick Streets, diagonally opposite Knox Church, was Mollison's Drapers and Clothiers. The 1903 New Zealand Cyclopaedia waxes lyrical in describing the store as it then was.
The ground floor forms one department known as the Dress and Ladies Department. An elliptic staircase leads to the showroom and ladies' fitting rooms. The new part of the building is entered through a nicely tiled doorway with the name of the firm let into the tiles, leading into the clothing department. Off this, there is a fitting room for gentlemen, the partitions of which are glazed with ornamental glass. Through a large artistic archway, the linoleum and carpet department is entered and is lighted from Frederick Street. Off this again, there is a public office, where there is a phone room, deafened so as to ensure privacy for the convenience of customers. Through an archway, the waiting room, three fitting rooms for ladies, and the mantle department are reached. The fitting rooms are finished with LED lights of hand-painted glass and a dado of salamander asbestos, and the ceilings are finished in the same way, with neatly cut cornices. Tiled gas stoves are provided for each room, thus ensuring the comfort of patrons and employees during the cold weather. Handsome lavatories are fitted up in this and in other portions of the building. The whole premises are exceedingly well lighted and present a brilliant appearance when in full swing after dark. Mollison's are in a position to afford every facility to the customers and the public generally, both in the matter of extent of choice and in the quality of materials. Through their London buyers, they have regular shipments coming from the best markets in the world.
No mention of escalators or lifts, but I understand many had the Lamson pneumatic system. You will remember these in Penrose's. The assistant puts your money and a docket into the little cylinder, then whoosh, off it shoots up to the ceiling, whizzes out of sight, returning very quickly with another whoosh and your change. The Lamson tube was developed in 1841 in Boston, subsidiaries being established in New Zealand and Australia in 1901. Then came the malls. In the suburbs, surrounded by free parking, the first New Zealand shopping court was in the state housing area of Nainai in 1954, followed by fully enclosed malls, Dunedin's Harvest Court, built on the site of the suddenly closed DSA in 1966, was Dunedin's first mall. The managing director, J. Gordon Dick, gave as the reasons for the DSA closing competition, increasing import controls, and high company taxation. The era of the great department stores gradually came to an end. Now, many of the malls in the USA lie empty and derelict as online mail order shopping takes over, with huge, heavily mechanized distribution centers working continuously 24/7 to fill and dispatch orders around the world. The trend here in New Zealand, if Queenstown is anything to go by, is for collections of mega chain stores where immigrant staff, self-service and checkout queues are the norm, surrounded by smaller shops, landscaped parking, including a petrol outlet. They are built on precious green land, a destination in themselves. The exclusive international labels are to be found as extravagant big-name boutiques clustered in international airports and luxury downtown shopping areas, where the rich and elegant can be seen purchasing outrageously expensive items from beautiful and immaculately groomed assistants in these mostly empty latter-day malls. I am no shopaholic, but I did enjoy the excitement of a trip to the department stores of old, and rather dread the trip to town today. Traffic snarl-ups, a quick dash in and out of the shops, an anxious check for chalk marks, then home as quickly as possible to avoid the rush hour. But I do wish someone would reinvent Santa's little house. I'd be there, traffic or no traffic. I'm grateful for the voice of Judy Southworth and to the New Zealand Cyclopedia and Cecily Geary for information. I am Anne Barrowclough reporting, and a Merry Christmas to you all.
This program, which will be repeated on Sunday at 7 p.m, is kindly sponsored by Ryman Healthcare and brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust. We'll be taking a break over Christmas and during January, but Heritage Matters will bring you highlights from the 2018 programs at the usual times or on podcast, starting on Christmas Eve. We wish you the warmest season's greetings. Ryman Healthcare prides itself on offering some of the most resident-friendly terms in New Zealand. Ryman Healthcare's Francis Hodgkins and Yvette Williams retirement villages in Dunedin offer the very best of retirement living and care. For more information and to discuss your retirement living options, please phone Kate on 455 7936. Ryman Healthcare, supporting Southern Heritage Trust and the Heritage Matters Programme.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.